It's a big day in Kansas City, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, as well as Up to Date, we will be taking you there thanks to members of KCUR's news team who are on the parade route right now. We'll be hearing from them and taking your calls. I can't wait to hear what the Chiefs mean to you. We will also find out how football got to be so popular in the first place. Kansas City has a lot to do with it. So yeah, lots of football on the show, but that's a little later in the hour. Our first discussion this morning is about college sports and student privacy. A former basketball coach at MU developed an app that tracks attendance for student athletes using their phones. MU is the only school in our area making use of the app, but they're beginning to expand its reach beyond athletics. That's got some people worried about student privacy infringement, particularly in the context of public universities. I'm Gina Kaufman, and here to clarify what the app can and can't do is Drew Harwell, a technology reporter at The Washington Post. Hi, Drew.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
What should listeners know about how this app even works? It's called Spotter, right?
Yeah, so Spotter is an attendance monitoring app, and what it does is use the Bluetooth ability on these students' cell phones, and the school puts these Bluetooth beacons in these specific classrooms. So if you're a student and you have the app, you go to class, your phone connects with this beacon, it tells the school, hey, I'm in class, I came on time, and then the administrator and the professor can know, okay, this was what my class looked like on any given day. So it doesn't use kind of the GPS, really precise location coordinates that you think of with your phone, but it does sort of allow the school to know in really precise terms who was there, when did they come, and how long did they stay.
And it's based on something that pings. I don't know what pinging is exactly, but bear with me. Something pings when they walk through the threshold of the classroom door.
Yeah, there's a radius for these little beacons that they install in the classroom. So if you set foot within, 60 to 90 feet of one of these beacons, the app sort of is notified, and then that goes into, the school database that tracks every student's attendance and tardiness, and even gives them sort of an attendance point score for the full semester.
Is it your perception that there is, from a technological standpoint, room for abuse?
Yeah, I think there's room for abuse with every technology, right? Like a karaoke machine, it can be used for good and evil.
I'm totally using that.
Right, as you should. So, with student athletes, they're already monitored in this precise way. Like a lot of these schools, including I think Mizzou, use sort of human class checkers where, these students take a GoPed around the campus and they make sure that these students are in class. And that's important to the team because, they have to fulfill all sorts of attendance and academic requirements to play as part of the competition. So in that way, you kind of see, okay, there's a way for the technology to be used in a way that could potentially save these professors time from checking attendance every day. But, every time you think about a student being surveilled in this way, all this data sort of going into this repository that's kind of managed by the school, and students being
graded. And these aren't children. They're adult students.
Yeah, I mean, these are adults. They're going to a college campus. This is the place where we expect students to become adults, right? We expect them to gain a new responsibility and an autonomy around sort of deciding their own schedule. And yet here we're sort of offloading the responsibility to this technical system that they don't have much control over.
The communications person at MU told us when we were kind of digging into this that it will be strictly opt-in. But even if it's opt-in, and even if, for now, the app just tracks whether you've entered the threshold of a classroom or not, is there some validity in the notion that the door has been kind of cracked open for people getting used to this kind of tracking? Like how we used to all read the terms of websites before clicking accept, and now we just click accept because otherwise our lives would just be impossible. Can you imagine an equivalent for students where opting out would be an option, but only really kind of in theory?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a real truth to this surveillance creep that we're seeing around the country. And even thinking about doorbell cameras and location trackers in our pockets, I mean, all these things have grown increasingly accepted by the public because, there's a convenience factor to it, just sort of makes life easier. So, with a lot of the colleges that I've talked to, they talk about these opt-ins sort of being an option, but really it's not an option at all, right? Like these students have to go to class, they're expected to sort of fit in. If you opt out of the phone, there's this whole other really kind of onerous process to log in a lot of places. In some places, a lot of the students have been telling me they didn't even know that they could opt out. So, there's this kind of default to just going along with whatever the school says is okay. And yet, I mean, there is a question of, okay, this is one class now, and this is one sort of set of student athletes. But, we're seeing in other schools where this is being applied to all students or all freshmen or anybody taking a specific class. And so, once the technology is online, it's really easy to add more students into the mix.
Drew, I
And,
just want to jump in and say something. It sounds like you have a cat in the background, and I just want to acknowledge it in case it's possibly like becoming distracting for our listeners because you're saying super interesting stuff. Acknowledged cat.
Cat acknowledged, trying to break into the classroom where I currently am. So sorry,
Okay.
everyone.
No problem. Go on.
So, it's often not a choice at all. And so for a lot of these students, there was a frustration like, I'm concerned about this, but I don't really have a say in the matter either way.
Yeah, student athletes in a lot of ways have a very different kind of college experience than non-athletes. And that's another piece of this. They are already monitored in all kinds of ways that other people don't deal with usually. And these questions about privacy also get discussed as they relate to drug testing. At some schools, it's mandatory for athletes. Some places just go by reasonable suspicion. Do you see this as a similar conversation, or is cell phone data different because we carry these phones and most of us don't understand very well what can and can't be known about us based on how we use them? Whereas I'm pretty sure I have to pee in a cup for drug testing.
Yeah, it is kind of a similar conversation, but the points you raise are good ones. The thing about student athletes is they just naturally have fewer rights than other students. That's just kind of the hidden reality that we don't really talk about. These students are accepted as sort of volunteers. They get tuition paid. They get all of these extra perks, but they're also sort of monitored in a really close way, for the benefit of the school. And so that's kind of why you see the surveillance capability kind of rolled out to them first. They have maybe less of a opportunity to say no. But yeah, I think you're right in that, drug testing and cell phone tracking are kind of similar ways that we monitor young people, any people. But the cell phone is just so purely a surveillance device in this really powerful way that we haven't really seen before, right? Like it has our location, it has a lot of details about us, it's on us all the time. And for these students, like there's never really a time when they're not connected to it. It's kind of part of their identity. And so to sort of see these schools be taking a more aggressive stance in kind of using that power for the school's kind of awareness and database gathering, I think that's kind of alarming.
Are you a sports fan?
A little bit, yeah.
Did you know that Kansas City's football team won the Super Bowl and everyone in this whole town is going nuts today because of a parade?
I've heard of something like that, yeah.
Okay, well, just checking on that because I was wondering, like, if there was anything anybody still doesn't know, as long as we're talking about the power of technology.
I mean, thinking about thinking about a big group of people all at one parade, thinking about all the location pings that come from a sort of mass, it's interesting to see, like, we're all sort of being surveilled at one time. But yeah, I don't think there's much I could share about the greatness of Kansas City sports that you all don't already know.
Drew Harwell of the Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and football will be the focus of today's show from here on out. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us what the Chiefs and their Super Bowl win mean to you. 816-235-2888. You can also send a tweet. We're at KCURCST. Kyle Palmer and Lisa Rodriguez are with us now from their perch in the middle of parade mayhem. Is that an accurate way to describe what you're seeing, guys?
I would say that's pretty accurate. Lisa, what do you think?
I think so. Getting more mayhem-y as the day goes on.
We should say, we should describe where we're at. So we're actually in an office on the fifth floor overlooking the north lawn of the north lawn of the World War I Museum and Memorial. So we're actually indoors, climate controlled, looking out on a sea of red, really.
Lucky
fans.
You.
We did kind of luck out with this. A sea of red, really. Fans red clad from Union Station all the way up the hill towards the Liberty Memorial. Lisa, we were talking about this before we got on the mics. Does this seem or feel as crazy as the 2015 Royals World Series parade yet?
I think it's growing. What's not quite there yet. I remember arriving at this location back in 2015, right after the parade. I snuck my way in, and it was packed. There was just no room for anybody. There is still more room for people to be filing in. Although I will say, the weather had held out for the first few hours of the day, and now it looks like some wet snow is coming down, and I'm very glad to be inside now. It looks quite unpleasant.
Yeah, and Lisa, you did a good job of getting out earlier this morning, and we were here at about 4 a.m., and there were fans that were here, had been here for a long time. In fact, you talked to one of them who was preparing for this cold weather.
I did. I talked to Glinda Bergen, who had arrived at 3. She was guarding her family's tent, and she gave me a rundown of how she prepared to stay warm for the day.
Well, I have on this. I was like a ski suit. I have on 3 layers under here, and my coat, 2 hats on, and a scarf, and 2 pairs of gloves.
So, Lisa, you're seeing a lot of people like that.
A lot of people like that. I will say her son Elijah was not pleased to be out at the cold at that hour, but she was well prepared.
Yeah, so it's a pretty festive atmosphere. We have the stage set up. There are giant TV screens both on either side of the stage as well as spaced throughout the yard. Big speaker stands, and really fans have been kind of pouring in steadily all morning. But as Lisa said, the snow is really, really starting to kind of pick up, but has not really seemed to dampen the people who are here yet.
Their moods, at any rate.
Well, Gina,
yes,
you have any more
Kyle.
Questions for us?
Well, how are you guys personally feeling about this moment? Is your own fandom getting kind of like, I mean, I can just even imagine you guys possibly getting kind of choked up at points in this.
I think it's getting there. When definitely being out in the crowd and talking to people and reliving with people those final seconds when the clock ticked down, the final seconds of the game, when you knew, when it sunk in that the Chiefs were Super Bowl champions, it is a little emotional, and it's hard not to get excited and to be really infected by that energy outside.
You have Lisa Rodriguez, Laura Ziegler, and Peggy Lowe, and Noah Taborda have also been out, and they've all been sending back clips of fans along the parade route who echo that sentiment. A lot of them kind of hit upon the theme of how big this is for Kansas City, how big it is for them as fans, because they've been with the Chiefs through thick and thin, through decades oftentimes of losing decades or seasons that ended with postseason disappointment. And so there is a lot of that emotion pouring out from the fans that I have heard from our reporters who have been out along the parade route this morning for sure.
Well, thank you both so much, and keep us posted. We'll be checking in with you later on, okay?
Absolutely.
Sounds good.
All righty. We will hear more from Kyle Palmer and Lisa Rodriguez taking us to the parade live later in the show. I'm Gina Kaufman, and when we return, the history of how football became America's sport and what the Chiefs mean to people here in town, people like you. 816-235-2888. Central Standard will be back in a minute. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now it's all football all the time, because that's what's up in Kansas City today. We will be taking your calls and tweets about what the Chiefs mean to you, starting with Lorenzo calling us from Florida. Hi, Lorenzo.
Gina, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Very happy.
Tell us the story of your relationship with the Chiefs and what the Super Bowl win has meant to you.
Um, Well, I can tell you probably my coworkers down here are pretty sick of it by now, of all of the red and forcing them to wear red on Fridays and everything else.
But they played along?
Oh, yeah. Well, they had to. I have my own penalty flag that I would throw at them if they didn't wear red on Fridays. It was getting out of hand. So I think I'm happy about the Super Bowl win, but I'm pretty sure they're ecstatic that it's over for their benefit. But it's incredible. I mean, it's a great feeling. It's something that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. I'm fortunate enough to see the Royals twice in '85 and in 2015. And, you know, this was phenomenal. So much heartbreak that we've had over a decade with close calls with the Chiefs. And to finally see them win it and to see them win it, you know, here in Kansas City, it was incredible. It's, you know, really can't put it into words. It's hard to believe waking up every day since it's happened that they're actually a champ.
The players on the team are celebrities who most of us don't know personally, but the other fans, that's not quite the case. Can you talk a little bit about how this sport connects you to other humans who do mean something to you in that sort of like really personal way?
Yeah. Honestly, it's like my dad's a huge sports fan, huge Kansas City sports fan. And I was born in Kansas City, but we lived in Florida from the time I was 4 until I graduated high school. And then I moved back to KC later on. But, you know, as you're growing up, you know, as a boy trying to, you know, going into adolescence and becoming a teenager, it's kind of difficult to, you know, always see eye to eye with your parents, you know, what they're trying to tell you to do and how they're trying to raise you. And so, you know, you tend to bump heads. And I think pretty much every teenager does that with their parents from time. But
football,
you know,
was different.
And, you know, with us, though, it was always amazing because, you know, no matter, you know, what was going on with us, you know, just in any part of life, we had the Chiefs. And growing up in Orlando, Florida, during Derek Thomas's heyday in Kansas City, you know, we had Monday night football games, and we were able to, you know, way before the internet, we were able to actually catch the Chiefs on national TV on Monday nights. Derek Thomas would dominate, and I can remember, you know, just sitting around with the family and just celebrating and going crazy and you know, just having a blast. And I think sports does that to an extent. I think more so when you're tied to Kansas City and a town like Kansas City, and to be proud when you live out of the state of that, not only that team, but that city, it really ties you close. And so, you know, as an adult, and, you know, my dad and I talked for hours the night of the Super Bowl, and as an adult, understanding kind of where my parents were trying to raise me and bring me up, and you know, having a fantastic relationship with them, and being very close, it was beautiful to really share that experience. And I think that's where the tears kind of came from that night, you know, as it set in that we were going to be the world champs.
Thank you so much for that call, Lorenzo, and congratulations on this big win. Lorenzo called 816-235-2888 to tell his story, and you can call in and tell your story too, 816-235-2888. Let me introduce the guest for this conversation, Michael McCambridge. He has written two books about the history of football, and one of them is specifically about us. It's called 69 Chiefs, A Team, A Season, and the Birth of Modern Kansas City. Michael McCambridge, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you. Happy Parade Day.
Thank you. We are going to be talking with you about the history of football, but Kansas City does play a big part in that because of Lamar Hunt, right?
That is correct. I think that it's good to remember that the reason there is a Super Bowl is that in 1959, Lamar Hunt started this new football league, the American Football League. And the team he founded, the Dallas Texans, moved in 1963 to Kansas City. And as the AFL succeeded, it eventually necessitated a merger between the old league, the NFL, and the new league, the AFL. And that required a world championship game, which Lamar himself suggested be called the Super Bowl. And so it was.
Do you feel like his legacy is part of what Kansas City is feeling right now as the Chiefs win their first Super Bowl in 50 years?
Certainly. And I think it was the experience of a lot of fans And Damian Williams talked about it on the Jimmy Kimmel Show Monday night, that there was actually more emotion after the AFC Championship game there in Arrowhead as Clark Hunt received the trophy named after his father, and the team finally got back to the Super Bowl for the first time in 50 years. Obviously, the Super Bowl is the ultimate prize, but there was something particularly fraught and emotional about finally winning the trophy named after Lamar Hunt. And so that there is that resonance that that exists around his legacy and what he meant to the team and what he meant to football at large.
Your more general book about the history of football is really about how football became such a popular sport in America. There was a turning point on that, right, where it was just a sport like any other sport, and then it blew up.
I think that's fair. My book, America's Game, begins around the end of World War II, at a time when pro football was really a third-class sport behind baseball, which was the national pastime, but also college football. And what got me to write the book in the first place was I wanted to figure out how, in the course of a generation between 1945 and 1970, pro football could eclipse baseball and become the nation's most popular sport. And it had a lot to do with the commissioner of the NFL from 1960 to 1989, Pete Rozelle, marketing the league in a shrewder, more sophisticated way. But it also had to do with Lamar Hunt as the catalyst, opening pro football to these new markets that had never been considered major league before, not just Kansas City, but Houston, Denver, Buffalo, San Diego. And those things coming together, and then the game being an authentically great, absorbing game that played really well on TV.
You have not mentioned television, which is usually the reason that is given, like the only reason that is given.
Well, I think going into it, there was, when I started writing the book, there was sort of the sense that just as soon as somebody pointed a television camera at a football field, that was it. Football was going to be more popular. But I think the reasons were more complex than that, and the implications were more profound than that. You also needed to have a group of people who were running the game who wanted to grow the game, who wanted to make it more palatable to a broader audience. Football was successful all throughout the 60s, but at the end of the 60s, when Pete Rozelle went and pitched to the major networks this idea of a primetime series of football games, nobody was interested because the feeling was that football was still too male, too parochial, too marginal to really succeed on primetime TV. But of course, Monday Night Football turned out to be a huge success, and now 40% of the viewing audience is female. And so a lot of that had to do with the vision of this is a game that can appeal to even more people. This is a game that has an inherent narrative drama that can be emphasized for people who might not understand the strategy or the X's and O's, but can still love the game. And that's one of the great things about football. You can have two people sitting together and one person might know the strategy, they know the personnel, they know the matchups. The other person just knows the Chiefs are the ones in red, and they can both thoroughly enjoy the game, right?
Michael McCambridge, it's interesting to me that you point to the narrative. What do you think, if I may, in just briefly, is the narrative of this Chiefs season?
I think this Chiefs season is about a couple things. First of all, it's about how a team handles adversity. You've got a situation in the middle of the season in which the magic unicorn quarterback is at the bottom of a pile facing south, and his kneecap is at the bottom of the same pile facing east, and it looks like all is lost. But the medical staff does a great job of popping the kneecap back in place. Mahomes is very tough. He's only out for a couple games after that, and he comes back, and the team deals without its savior. But while it's doing that, everybody comes together, everybody works a little bit more with a little bit more focus and clarity. The much maligned defense that arguably cost the Chiefs a trip to the Super Bowl last season begins to gel, begins to get a sense of its own personality and what is possible. And then things start falling into place. The Patriots lose the last game of the regular season, so the Chiefs get a bye. Then the Baltimore Ravens get upset, so the Chiefs get to play the AFC Championship game at home. All those things fall together. And I think that the larger lesson, the larger theme or narrative, if you will, is persistence. Andy Reid has been coaching in the NFL for 21 years, and up until Sunday at 9 o'clock, his reputation was he couldn't win the big ones. And that's everybody's reputation until they do win the big ones. And Andy Reid finally did.
Well, Michael McCambridge, stay with me. I want to go now to some of our callers at 816-235-2888 who are here to tell their personal stories of what Kansas City's football team means to them. We've got Howard with us from Overland Park. Hi, Howard.
Hello, everyone. I was in attendance at the NFL's longest game ever played. It was from the Chiefs in overtime, lost to the Dolphins here in 1971. And if you look at the, I had a standing room ticket and I stood that entire game. And if you look at the microfilm, if you want, on the 15-year anniversary of that game, and the Star's sports section said, 15 years later, the loss still hurts. So I want to thank the Chiefs for getting this 48-year-old monkey off my back. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. Michael, anything to say about that call as someone who has just studied this team and this sport so intensely?
Oh, yeah. The game is still vivid. It was Christmas Day, 1971. I was 8 years old. I discovered the power of fervent prayer that day and also understood that not all prayers are answered. First cut is the deepest. That was an amazing, epic game, but it was also sort of the end of the era of that classic Chiefs team of the late 60s and early 70s. The team was aging and never quite got back to the heights it had attained. But we didn't know that at the time. It was the year before Arrowhead Stadium opened, and 1972 began with all of this optimism because the Chiefs were moving into this ultra-modern, state-of-the-art stadium. But the players, those great players, were aging. They were in their 30s, and they just weren't as good as they had been. And it all started going downhill. And it was a brutal stretch, the 70s and 80s. One playoff appearance in the next two decades. And that's where this quest to get back to where the Chiefs were at the end of the 60s began. And it was a long, epic, difficult, heartbreaking road, as your caller Howard could attest.
We have a tweet from a listener by the name of Todd. He says, my mom and I had season tickets throughout the 90s while I was a teenager. Sundays out at Arrowhead was our religion. Opted out of tickets once they got too expensive to continue. In Chicago now, missing KC at this very moment, and it's driving me crazy. The expatriate fan experience has to be sort of bittersweet right now.
Well, I think the tweet's very valid because the beginning of the 90s was the beginning of the Renaissance. When Carl Peterson came in as general manager and hired Marty Schottenheimer as head coach, you began to get this sense of the franchise heading in the right direction. And by 1991, you got to see the power of what Arrowhead could be, this fortress, this cauldron that teams did not want to go into. There was a Monday night game in 1991 where the Chiefs played the Buffalo Bills, who'd been to the Super Bowl the year before, and just destroyed them 33-6. And I've had people who were there that night saying it was the loudest they'd ever heard a stadium. I don't think they were measuring decibel levels then, but it was bedlam. And I haven't lived in Kansas City since 81, but I well remember coming back in the early 90s, reconnecting with my high school friends, my old friends, and just getting a sense of Arrowhead is the place to be. And it was, we all return.
Well, Michael McCreanbridge, hang on with me. We're going to check in now with KCUR's Kyle Palmer and Lisa Rodriguez at the parade downtown. What's happening, guys?
Hey, Gina, how are you doing?
Good. I'm so excited to hear those shouts in the background.
Yeah, we are actually indoors, but we are looking out over the field in front of Union Station, and it is getting fuller and fuller by the minute. Lisa has been out and about. You've been in that crowd.
I've been in that crowd. It's been harder and harder to navigate all morning. I just went a few minutes ago outside, and there is still a steady stream of people coming in from every direction. Talked to a couple people that parked and walked 2 miles to get here in front of Union Station. So it's big and gonna get bigger.
You guys, speaking of the way Kansas City's sports enthusiasm can sound, even when there's just the structure of a building surrounding you, that you are indoors right now with that sound is not unbelievable to me, because I recognize those sounds from just when the Chiefs won on Sunday night. The sound from inside my house was crazy. This is a very sonic experience.
Yeah, well, we just, you know, just listening to your guest talk about Arrowhead Stadium and kind of the mystique that has been built up around that and the crowd noise and the home field advantage. I think a lot of Chiefs fans here in the bowl around Union Station trying to, in a little bit, recreate that mood at Arrowhead Stadium with the vibe very much kind of like a tailgate and like a Chiefs game for sure.
Absolutely. I had people tell me that they're treating this like a tailgate. They brought their snacks, they brought their blankets, they brought their coolers, and they've been here since early this morning.
I hear that there was a police chase. A car chase.
There was, you know, amidst all of this positivity and joy, there was a tense and very scary moment for a lot of spectators when a car made it through the barricades right at the beginning of the parade route at 6th and Grand and made it all the way almost to the end of the parade route before it was ultimately stopped by police right in front of Crown Center. But there were people right there on the barricades, didn't know what was going on. People were panicking a bit. People were running. And that car kind of spun around, you know, before it was ultimately stopped by police and did look like it was heading toward the crowd. And we do have a spectator that was there to see it and describes kind of that moment for
We saw a couple of the sheriffs start running down this street north on Grand. They opened their trunks and they immediately grabbed their spike strips and rolled them out, and then we saw it was like a gold Taurus, and his tires were totally flat, and he had about 5 or 6 police cars chasing right after him, so it's pretty intense.
Yeah, but we should be clear, Gina, that the police have arrested 2 suspects, and they say this has no indication of anything terrorism related. It just seems to have been a joyride gone terribly wrong, but no one was injured as well. So now, about an hour and a half or 2 hours later from when that happened, this crowd is fully back into the mode of celebrating the Chiefs.
Any good signs you've seen or good T-shirts? I always love the gear and the slogans people come up with.
People are dressed up. We've got people selling T-shirts to the crowd, selling commemorative posters. I've seen some Andy Reid lookalikes. I saw a full-on a person in a blow-up Santa Claus outfit wishing everybody a Merry Chiefsmas. So people are festive, and they're out, and they're decked out.
And there is a guy selling shirts right underneath where we're at the Institute for Human Development, about 5 stories below, selling shirts that I can't say on air what the message is, but it looks like he's been selling them steadily all morning.
And you'll remember that slogan, and I will ask you about it off air.
Yeah.
Well, so it sounds like they're celebrating every holiday out there. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you.
Anytime. We are off to a break, but we'll have more football stories and football history when KCUR's Central Standard returns. You can join the fun at 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we've got just a little time left to learn about the history of football as Kansas City gets psyched, remains psyched this day of the big Super Bowl victory parade, and we will take more of your calls about what the Chiefs mean to you at 816-235-2888, but you got to call now. Michael McCambridge, author of 69 Chiefs, A Team, A Season, and Birth of a Modern Kansas City, as well as America's Game, the epic story of how pro football captured a nation. Welcome back.
Good to be back. Good to still be here.
Can I ask you a question that might seem so basic that you're just going to like roll your eyes at me, but I am curious and I can't help it.
You mean you don't do football shows every day?
I do not. The shape of a football intrigues me, and I have to, I have to assume there is something primal about the human impulse to throw and catch round objects. It's like, it's got to be in our DNA. But the football isn't round. Where did that weird, weird shape come from?
You know, you're going to have to talk to another football historian about that, because I could pretend like I had an answer, but I really don't.
It makes me so happy that you don't know either, because it is the shape is so weird that we actually call it a football shape because nothing else is shaped like it.
It has been called an oblate spheroid.
I'm
not smart enough to understand exactly what that means scientifically. I can tell you this. When the American Football League started in 1960, the Lamar Hunt and the founders of the league made a decision to have a slightly slimmer football, about a quarter of an inch less in circumference, to make it easier to throw, to encourage more passing. And one of the things that characterized the early years of the American Football League was it was a more wide-open game with more passing.
And then that sort of moves it like a little bit more away from ball shape and a little more toward javelin.
Exactly. Well put.
Do you think that the uniqueness of the shape of the ball contributes to the uniqueness of the sport, or am I reaching here?
I don't think I can answer that without sounding pretentious, so I'm going to pass on that. I do think...
Football pun.
I do think that the great thing, one of the great things about football is the ball isn't round, so the bounces are not always true. You know, a basketball... You make a bounce pass in basketball, you know pretty much exactly where it's going. But that football comes out and goes in the ground. It could go in any direction. That's one of the things that makes the game can be so random in that respect.
Kansas City fans have been notorious from the beginning. And I understand that Chiefs fans were once known as the Wolf Pack.
Yeah, there was a story in the Kansas City Times late in 1965 about the fans right behind the benches in the old Municipal Stadium, and how they would cheer so loudly, they were so supportive, but they were also vociferous when they were displeased with the team, and they became known as the Wolf Pack, always howling about one thing or another. The Chiefs at the end of the 65 season were starting a new season ticket campaign, and in a little bit of marketing genius, they sort of co-opted that reputation and what could have been a negative and turned it into a positive. The season ticket campaign that year was Join the Wolf Pack, and they created this sort of stylized animated version of a wolf, which was really the seeds of the KC Wolf mascot we have now. And over the course of that off season, the season ticket base grew from like 9,000 season ticket holders to 21,000. It was very, very successful, and it was one of the things that brought the city together and unified them behind those Chiefs of the 60s.
It's interesting because as you talk about this, it really strikes me that Chiefs fans celebrate Chiefs fans, as you know, that's part of what they're out there celebrating, is that this like kinship and passion that they all share.
Oh yeah, it's the scene outside Arrowhead Stadium, and I've been to dozens of pro football stadiums. There's nothing quite like it. There's that sense of not just the camaraderie and not just the tailgating and all the great barbecue, but you can walk down any aisle in that parking lot and hear Willie Nelson and Beyonce and Kanye and the Eagles. And it is just such a great melting pot of different outlooks and different perspectives on American life. It's still one of the most wonderful places to be in the world on a Sunday morning.
Are there any other episodes in the history of football becoming, as you put it, America's sport that we haven't talked about that you feel like our listeners today would just really love hearing?
I think that the listeners today have got to be mostly focused on the Kansas City Chiefs. So I will avoid the other ones. But I think if there's a story to tell, I think it's this. In the 1969 season, the Chiefs went on the road to play the defending world champion New York Jets in the first round of the playoffs, beat them, went on the road 2 weeks later to face the team with the best record in pro football that year, the Oakland Raiders, and beat them, and then went down to the Super Bowl where they were heavy underdogs and beat the Minnesota Vikings 23-7. After that game, for the first time in history, the President of the United States called the winning locker room to congratulate the team, congratulated Len Dawson, the Super Bowl MVP. Dawson tells a story about the locker room after the game and all the media's in there and TV. And the equipment manager, Bobby Yarbrough, said, "Len, it's the phone. It's the president." And Dawson said, "The president of what?" And he said, "The president, Nixon, the president of the United States." So there was a scene in which this unprecedented thing happened. And of course, that 69 team has historic significance. It was the first team in pro football history in which a majority of the starters were African-American. I think any city is going to embrace a champion, but there was something particularly significant about that team representing Kansas City in that era and that time. And I think the Chiefs of the late 60s helped change the perception of what the city was about, what the city was capable of. Here's this innovative, ultra-modern, diverse team representing a city that 10 years earlier had been primarily known for what? Being a cow town and being a mafia town. And those perceptions started to change around the time of the 69 Chiefs.
You know, Michael, we have a call that I think you're going to really appreciate. We've got a call from John in Overland Park. John, tell us your story.
Well, good morning. I was having to be listening, of course, but I was involved in creating the Wolfpack. Our agency took over the account.
Valentine Radford?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I worked at VR and developed the I was the art director and developed the and did the artwork and developed the wolf. And we took the idea, and I think you mentioned that, I didn't catch all of it, but from a news article that was from the Rowdy fans that from their last game of this previous season, and we came up with that idea. But it was mentioned in the article about this Wolfpack group that made so much noise. So we took that idea and developed it into that campaign for the next season ticket drive, as you described. And it really was a success.
But it was a great marketing campaign.
John,
and it was a great wolf.
And what's it like for you now that the wolf is the mascot for the team, John? Does that feel sort of like special to you?
Well, of course it does. It does. But you notice when we did the wolf, we never revealed all of him because we wanted to keep him kind of anonymous. So we only showed his eyes and his ears. And then we used that idea through the campaigns from there on. We started using photos of fans, if you remember, and we'd show the head, and then we'd put the ears over it, and do a whole campaign of newspaper and posters, etc. We ran with that for two or three more years.
So, like, the wolf could be anyone.
Yes, that's the idea.
Well, thanks for that call, John. Michael.
It's a wonderful campaign, and anybody who was around then, you show that stylized illustration of the wolf, and it is evocative. You remember the time and place, and there were Wolfpack scarves and Wolfpack posters, and the wolf was on the schedule card that was distributed at grocery stores and convenience stores. It was a terrifically successful campaign.
Michael McCambridge, author of two books about football, you have lived in Kansas City in your own past. As you've mentioned, what do the Chiefs mean to you, not as a writer, not as a historian, not as an expert, but just as a person?
The Chiefs are one of the things, for better or worse, that I mark my life by. I can remember where I was so many times based on, okay, the Chiefs lost this game here or they won this game here. And I haven't lived in Kansas City since 1981. My mother moved away a few years later. Almost all of my friends in high school live someplace else. So when I think of Kansas City being my home, and I think of a place that feels like home, the one place that has not changed significantly is the stadium at One Arrowhead Drive. When I come home to Kansas City, it's often to go to a football game at Arrowhead Stadium. And so the Chiefs and their fortunes over the decades is one of the things that I mark my life by. And there certainly, and this is the experience of a lot of fans, you would be hard-pressed to think of anything else in your life that you care about so passionately and yet you have so little control over. That's the fans' experience. We are there to support. We are there to witness. We are there to experience empathy and experience the humanity and share in the experience. And there's nothing really like it. You know, you don't get that watching Netflix at home.
And that's also, you know, you're there to throw a big parade. So let's check back in now with Kyle Palmer and Lisa Rodriguez at KCUR's remote studio on the parade route. Hello. Wow. I'm not going to ask if you're there because I can hear that you are.
Yeah, we are there, and there's a hype man who has come out on stage and has been leading the crowd through some songs and getting them excited. It had been kind of like a murmur before, but now in the last 5 to 10 minutes, Lisa, we've definitely noticed an uptick in the energy.
Yes, the energy is picking up for sure, and that is about half an hour, a little bit more than half an hour before this parade is set to start down Grand up at 6th and Grand and make its way to where we are now.
So I hear that you all have been out talking to people and really hearing a lot of excitement, and I wonder what it is exactly that you are hearing.
Well, we're hearing a lot of the same things that your guest is talking about during this hour, the pride that comes with being a longtime Chiefs fan, also maybe some of the disappointments and suffering that have gone along with that. But I think people today are really feeling on an all-time high when it comes to the Chiefs. Here are a few of the fan voices we've collected so far today.
I think it means everything. It's going to bring this city together. I love it. I love it. I think we're going to have about five more back-to-back. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, geez. Well, I didn't want to miss this. I mean, I don't know. It might be another 50 years. So, like, stuff like this doesn't happen every single year. Like, we know that as Chiefs fans. So, you don't pass up an opportunity like that.
I'm so proud of our city. I wouldn't miss this for the world. It's worth bringing all of our kids out here for and standing in the cold. It's a monumental event, and we are so happy to be here.
So, that was in order James Ellington, Brenton Hanisch, and Carrie Myers. Just some of the tens of thousands of Chiefs fans out here right now.
You guys, I am experiencing a first right now in that I feel like I could cry if I were not on the air right now. And I've never felt like crying about football. Never, 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 never.
That's something that I've heard a lot today. People close to tears, people who recounted those final seconds of the game and said that they burst into tears. This is something that that people are going to remember the rest of their lives, and it's especially touching. I've talked to a couple younger Chiefs fans, 10, 11 years old, and they're telling me they're going to remember being here. They're going to remember this win, you know, as they move forward as Chiefs fans. And lucky for those younger fans, they may have more of these in the future. We're hoping that there isn't another 50-year dry spell.
Anything else to say to us before we let you go?
We should say we're at the Institute of Human Development, which is part of UMKC. That's why we were able to get this office overlooking this great panorama. And the people who are here were back here in 2015, and they say the crowd right now looks about the size it did at that time of day in 2015. So we're expecting another massive, historically big crowd today.
Well, Kyle Palmer, Lisa Rodriguez, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll hear more from them on Up to Date. Michael McCambridge, any parting words for us about how this moment fits into Chiefs history?
There's nothing better than a world championship parade. I remember Len Dawson talking about the parade in 1970, and he said, people were so happy. There was, the car was going down, I think it was Grand Avenue, and somebody threw their hand on the windshield and left their watch on the windshield wiper. They were just so frantic and ecstatic. And he said it was almost frightening to see how happy people were.
Well,
but that's what this sport does.
Yes, we have to leave it there. Michael McCambridge is the author of two books, 69 Chiefs, A Team, A Season, and The Birth of Modern Kansas City, and America's Game, the epic story of how pro football captured a nation. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Go Chiefs.